Hello, friends and folks, and welcome back to Romance of the Two Networks. This is our journey through Romance of the Three Kingdoms, chapter by chapter, with two networks in tow, but the second network has changed. This time, I'm Six Detmar from Scanline Media.
I'm Jennifer Uncle for Scanline Media.
And we're joined this week by the illustrious freelance tactics genius. Would you prefer tactics genius or strategy genius, Rowan?
Operational? No, either one is good.
I would call you the Kong Ming of freelance journalism, but that feels somewhat insulting, and I don't mean to do that.
Yeah, I learned not to invade the same place 8 times in a row and lose every time.
I haven't, so, you know. But we'll work on that. You know, actually, part of this podcast could be you giving me tactical advice, because I know for Jen and I, we're not usually much of tactics people, but Total War Three Kingdoms has captured our hearts. But just in the off chance there are people who are listening who don't know you, Rowan, even though you are definitely better known than us. What is the Rowan Kaiser experience?
I am a video game and speculative fiction critic, although I am largely, I don't know if it's on hiatus or retired, but I haven't written much, too much lately, but I am still a regular for Three Moves Ahead, which is the premier strategy and tactics and war game podcast. It's on the Idle Thumbs network, so you can add that into your number of networks that you're romancing now. That's a nice feather. I've never been on Idle Thumbs itself, but we are part of the network. But yeah, my focus is generally in games. It's on strategy games or RPGs, although I play just about everything but modern military shooters. I have been into Three Kingdoms stuff since discovering Dynasty Warriors in college almost 20 years ago. Have been into Total War almost the exact amount of time. I didn't love Shogun and Medieval, but when Rome came around in 2004, that was when I was hooked, and it's been one of the better and more important game series for me. So Total War Three Kingdoms was an extremely natural fit that I had high expectations and standards for, and we could get into that momentarily.
For sure. So I have listened to the Three Moves Ahead episodes on this game and its expansions, though I notice y'all haven't covered World Betrayed, at least not yet.
Yeah, we just sort of go into the expansions when we feel like it's time to, as opposed to doing each and every one of them. I suspect we will probably do one whenever the next one comes out, which I'm expecting will be on Guandu and flesh out Yuan Shao. But, like, we were joking for our 500th episode show last night that we might just want to retire and do a Three Kingdoms only podcast, so.
Yeah, the game is really good is the thing.
Yes, it's obscenely good. It's, like, the only thing that we kind of default to wanting to play, and has been basically since it was released, but especially with the two expansions from earlier this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've been very good expansions.
Yeah, they've given it just a little more rounding so that it feels like you can just play it over and over and over, as opposed to merely being an incredibly good game that you might feel finished with as it was on release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that you mentioned there actually is so I am new to Total War. I played Total War Shogun 2. Way back in the day when I got like an Alienware laptop, and I was like, I bet this thing could run a cool game. And so I played Shogun 2 and I was like, yep, it can run it. Why am I playing this on a trackpad? And that was sort of that, which was foolish of me.
Yes, that was a truly great one.
Well, I guess that means I still have it in my library, so I should go back to it.
That is true, although it's become a little outdated. It's become a lot outdated on the strategic map. The tactical level is still probably the best in this series, but the the strategic map has been thoroughly outclassed, especially by Three Kingdoms, which if you have not listened to our 3MA episodes on it, like, we love the game in general, but the way that the map handles history and strategic interactions and everything about, like, just how it's put together, how it looks, how it feels is above and beyond just about any other video game we've ever played.
Yeah, it's been wonderful to see as we're reading the book three chapters at a time. We're up to chapter 97 now, so we're getting pretty close to the end.
Oh, dang.
And just watching, like, how faithful and how loving a rendition of that book it's been has been really, really yes. great.
I have, like, this kind of model of what I want a historical game to look like, and it's that it doesn't necessarily have to follow history, but the idea that history could be followed via letting it simulate or even the player being involved in it is actually plausible. And mm-hmm. like most other Three Kingdoms games I played, I mean, Romance of the Three Kingdoms from Koei is the big one for that goes at the macro level. Like, they just don't succeed, or they, like, really shoehorn events just into the idea that you can get, you know, Liu Bei down in the southwest part of China 20 years in. Whereas Total War Three Kingdoms handles it somewhat with events, but generally just by setting things up so that things naturally flow in a way that feels historical, even though you can have wildly divergent endings. I don't want to say endings. Wildly divergent mid-game setups.
Results, perhaps.
Yes, there we go. Weird word to forget. Wildly divergent results and wildly divergent stories, but they all seem plausible with, like, what might have happened had history tilted at different ways a few times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get the sense that at certain points, like, well, at least in my Sun Jian campaign, Dong Zhuo ended up dying of old age, but it felt like our objectives didn't change all that much compared to how things went in the book. It was still like, okay, we still need to figure out a way to take this area back and potentially restore the Han, while the Han is slightly fighting us while still being under the control of that specific faction.
Yeah, and, like, each of the different start dates deals with those things in a kind of different way. Like, in the 194 start date, it's obviously, like, Dong Zhuo is gone, and you just have the petty little leaders scrabbling over the remains, and they're not, like, a big deal. The 190 start date, I think, needs to fiddle with that a bit more, because it just sort of leaves that faction up. But that's getting really into the nitty-gritty, but yeah, it's... and then the 182 start date, which is before the Yellow Turban Rebellion, like, it has some events that lead to the collapse of the Han and Dong Zhuo taking power to some extent, but these events have to be triggered. They have to, like, come along via having defeated the Yellow Turbans, or you might still be fighting the Yellow Turbans at that point. It's... it. How and when and, like, how powerful Dong Zhuo is, how powerful the other factions are when he makes his move, like, these are all things that can slightly get tweaked and just lead to maybe a slight divergence in history that corrects, or maybe stuff just gets really wild.
So I'm anything but a grand strategy expert, right? I have played this, I have played some Stellaris, and for the record, I'm with you on Stellaris. and I have played CK2, Crusader Kings 2. And one of the things that has struck me, especially with a few of the campaigns I've played of Total War Three Kingdoms, is I don't know the Total War series as a whole, but it seems like it's trying to do some more, like, Crusader Kingsy things, perhaps?
Yeah, it's got more relationships in it. I think they could be made more important. But yes, this is sort of the key thing about if you're making something in the Three Kingdoms saga. The Three Kingdoms saga is not Wei versus Wu versus Shu. It's here are all these different people who represent parts of each different faction and all have relationships with one another, and figuring out how to model that in a game that's actually interesting, because it's not an interesting setting and story just because like the technology was important or the war was particularly interesting. It's an interesting setting because you have basically a bunch of superheroes running around stabbing each other in the back or the face. And so you really need to have that Crusader Kings style relationship modeling, the ability to have people run away, people betray you, spies, your best friend dies in the middle of battle and your characters go crazy and like just wreck everything else. All those things are necessary parts of making it feel like a successful Three Kingdoms game.
Totally. I appreciate how they render that larger than life setup by having the generals being rendered as literal giants when they're walking around the map. And when you get into the nitty gritty fights, if you're not simulating them all the time, which I tend to lean on because I'm not the best at the strategy part, but the battle part anyway, but it's really exciting to hear them taunt each other. And sometimes I'll just let the rest of the army do what they're doing and I'll zoom in as close as possible and watch these two generals go at it, and I get really into rooting for them as they go.
I mean that's what you want in a game like this. You don't want this sort of like personality free strategic concept. You want this idea of being able to go from like the personal to the grand map of China and back and forth, and you know, get into Zhangfei and all of your best friends and worst enemies having their rivalries.
But it's interesting because I feel like I want to play a lot more of this game. I've been having such a great time with it lately, and before that too, it was my personal game of the year for last year. But I feel like some of the games I played more recently have sort of brought into definition what I feel like the strengths and the weaknesses of some of its stuff is. Like, I think specifically it's the campaign I played as Lu Bu in the World Betrayed, and then it's the Lu Ji campaign I played in Mandate of Heaven. Because the Lu Ji campaign really made me wish for more Crusader Kings 2 in this game. Because I don't know if you've played as him, Rowan, but basically he's the mentor of Xuanda, of Liu Bei, and he starts out like in history he dies pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But in this, it's like you start with a city and a farm right next to all the Yellow Turbans as they revolt, and you just kind of can't do anything for like 10 years. You kind of just have to have a garrisoned army. And hope that the Yellow Turbans don't seriously just try to crush you and just hit next turn over and over, and it's kind of frustrating.
And what made you think there should be more of a Crusader King style thing there?
I wish there was more like events. I wish there was more like diplomacy or something I could do. It felt really like I felt comfortable with how defensive it was, but like on the like as far as when I didn't have combat to deal with, suddenly it felt like there was almost nothing for me to do.
Yeah, I think some of the balancing on the World Betrayed is a little bit off in that it's really hard to have a quick end to the Yellow Turban Rebellion as, you know, actually happened. Sometimes it's like they've been beaten, but they just sort of drag things out for like 20 years. Or it takes like 10 years and they eventually manage to take Luo Yang, and then that's just game over for everybody, which that was a surprise. But yeah, there's I can see how that would not necessarily be like perfectly balanced in a way that would make him fun, which might be why I never was particularly interested in playing as him. I did play as Liu Bei in that campaign, and you know, you're basically spending those first 5 years just sort of running around fighting Yellow Turban fires, and then maybe everyone else gets their shit together enough that you can strike back at them. But yeah, the north in that scenario is a rough place to be.
Yeah. And so it just made me wish for more things I could do with my own court, and more just, you know, more peacetime actions, or even just ways to coordinate with my allies, because I have played, like, I did play like Zhang Shui, the leader of the Yellow Turban Rebellion. I did play a campaign as him. And the ability to coordinate with your brothers in that is really useful. You can sort of basically point at people and say, you know, like, go get them. And it makes sense that like Lu Ji can't do that. He doesn't have that kind of authority. But it does make it really frustrating when, as you mentioned, like, you're the one part of this massive coalition of the entire, you know, vassals of the Han Empire, and everybody else is just twiddling their thumbs with their huge armies.
Yeah, I think that's because that's a coalition or an empire. If they were like in the ally mode of the game, you can actually do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the nature of how that it connects people. And I guess that does create a role-playing thing, right? Where when the coalitions exist, everyone's just doing their kind of their own thing, and nobody is able to successfully control them, which happened with the Yellow Turbans to some extent, and obviously the Anti-Dog Joe Coalition was nothing but that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that makes sense in a role-playing aspect, but in terms of giving you things to do, that can be a bit of an issue. For me, the lack of the Crusader King's interpersonal relationship stuff happens mostly in the endgame, mm-hmm. where you get these buffs when you're at, like, duchy and kingdom level in the game that basically keep people loyal almost no matter what, unless you like hire a level 8 Dynasty Warriors level character out of nowhere, and then you basically just have to promote them and they'll be okay. Mm-hmm. But those are the points when it's most interesting and to some extent historical for people to want to break free. Like in the very, very late game, like those are the things that most affected how, or not game, in the story, the history, those are the things that most affected how we ended up with the Suma clan taking over, was, you know, putting down the rebellions and successfully launching their own coups and surviving Cao Hu Bei deserting over to Shu. These are what ends up like being the story after Kang Ming dies, and mm-hmm. those aren't really modeled. And the game does generally end around, you know, the Wuzhang Plains era. It's generally 230 to 235 that every one of my campaigns has ended in. But yeah, in the late game, I really wish there was more like my governors have to really be assuaged constantly. My top generals are not like running off starting their own wars like Guan Yu did. Those sorts of things are somewhat missing, and I actually kind of want to see if there's a mod that just like doubles dissatisfaction. That might make the early game kind of a pain, but I feel like it would add a lot to the late game and potentially make it into more of a late era Three Kingdoms simulation, which it doesn't have, although I guess theoretically it could be, but if you're simulating it, but the player is just too smart to let the 50-year stalemate exist.
Yeah, I mean, I think I could have had the 50-year stalemate if I'd played a little smarter in my campaign as Lu Bu. Because I don't know if have you played at all as Lu Bu in A World Betrayed?
I played a little bit as him, but like not deep into it. Basically just got the idea of what he was supposed to be doing, got my ass kicked, was like, all right, I'll come back to this soon.
I had so much fun with that. Because I think all of his unique mechanics are really interesting. The fact that he's got like so much corruption and all of his men inherently hate him and the greatest warrior stuff. And basically the way it went for me is that everybody had like bigger concerns and I was sort of an unstoppable military juggernaut for a lot of it. Once I settled the initial problems, which are severe, but then you were just sort of unstoppable because anytime you did a battle, they classically call Lubo the warrior worth 1,000. And he is in this game. If you take, if you do a battle and it says you're supposed to lose if you hit delegate, if you go into it with Lubo and just have Lubo run up and kill their generals, then they rout.
Yeah, that's, there are some other characters who can get that later in the game, but yeah, he definitely has some subcomponents of that. And yeah, like that modeling the idea that he's going to be absolutely terrifying tactically, but a total mess strategically is, you know, exactly what they should be doing. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons that I find myself preferring the 194 start is that like the little components of his campaign and Sensei's campaign that like have them built on this momentum idea. It feels like it turns the whole strategic map into this interesting thing. Because most times I've had him as a faction leader, Lubu, I mean, he's survived for decades, but not ever, like, become a superpower, which is really interesting and, like, probably what might have happened had he not pissed too many people off at exactly the same time. Like, he's going to beat your armies, but he's not going to be able to hold land because he's too much of a jackass.
Well, and even if you're playing him, I totally believe it's possible to win as Lubu. I did not. I made it to the point where I declared myself emperor, but by that point, just by, like, the debuffs you get for, like, respect from everyone, when I declared myself emperor, everyone declared war on me, basically, including, like, you know, like, noted pacifist Tao Ken, who messaged me to say that I'm disgusting, and all the bandits who called me up to say that I'm an insult to the concept of an emperor. And basically, all of China turned on me. I mean, it did, but also, I played like a real piece of shit, so...
Yeah.
So I do, like, I don't know, there was something about that where, like, when it came to the end of the campaign, and it was like, I was playing, like whack-a-mole, and then it turned out they weren't moles, they were hydras, and every time I crushed one, I got 9 more. And it's like, my armies can only be so many places at once. And I ended up, like, using an option that I never thought I would use, which is, like, there were 2 other emperors, there was Lu Biao, who, fuck that guy, and there was Ma Tang, and I called up Ma Tang, and I was like, all right, buddy, you win. And I assumed I would just play till the bitter end with everybody, but that, like, in that moment, I felt the role of Lu Bu, of being like, I just feel beat down, can someone just make this stop?
Yeah. And, you know, switching masters when you get bored of everyone hating you.
For sure. But the problem is, and like I understand, especially given the like the roots of this series, but I really think it's a bummer that like in that situation there where we were at 3 kingdoms and then we went down to 2 and I just got a splash screen with, you know, black and white art that said defeat. I didn't get to see how things played out from there.
Yeah, that's the abdicate thing is like an instantly Ma Tang's takes all your land, which is, it's not you like swear vassalage, which was very helpful for me in finishing off a game that was proving quite difficult to finish off. But I could definitely see why the game would say, yes, this is over here. But I mean, that sort of makes sense. Like there's no coming back from declaring yourself emperor. Like,
sure. But I mean, even if it's not like, even if it's not gameplay, I would still just like to see how things ended. It feels like an unresolved story.
Yeah. An observer mode kind of thing. I wonder if it has. I doubt it does. I know Paradox games do.
I haven't found anything like that, but.
Is there any benefit to accepting a vassalage like a... operating underneath a different nation for a bit, because it seems like it'd be a really easy way to have the tide turn against you, or just be second fiddle to someone for most of the rest of the game.
So the campaign I just did, I was playing as Yuan Shu, who everyone really hates.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really interesting one because he also only starts with one Dynasty Warrior level character, and that's Ji Ling, and he's not actually even that good in the context of the game and his stats. Basically, like, the entire first half of the game, I was trying to make sure that Cao Cao did not come at me because I had nobody that could fight off his generals. Like, Jian Wei and Zhao Hudun and all the rest would just, like, be able to turn any battle that I could have theoretically won. I mean, I could still beat them occasionally, but it was just, like, too much of a pain in the ass. So, until I managed to get Zheng Zhang and get her leveled up, and there's an unbeatable beast in the late game.
Yes.
Good lord,
yes.
She is fun to have. Until I could get someone who could actually, like, break that spearhead, what I would basically do was try to severely limit as much land as Cao Cao could take, and sometimes that involved swearing vassalage. I think I was vassalized to him once, Yuan Shao once, and me and I think it would have been Sun Quan, back and forth multiple times, where he was my vassal, I was his vassal, back and forth, until I eventually got, like, enough generals and enough of a foundation that I was able to hold my own. But that was, like, the first 20 years of that campaign, was you swear vassalage, you take on your leader's diplomatic statuses. Mm-hmm. So if Cao Cao is at war with you and you swear vassal to him, he's not going to be at war with you anymore. It's a big hit on the economy, but it can be super necessary when you just don't have the ability to fight them off. And that was a real fun campaign in that way, because you're also on the central plane, so there's no real, like, choke points. It's just figuring out where you can hit the point enough to get a foundation and, like, develop your generals to be able to stand up on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Huh, okay. That sounds like it generates some pretty interesting stories then.
Yes, I found that the 194 start generally does. Like, all of them are pretty good, but that one was just kind of ridiculous in terms of there were 7 different duchies before I hit the 3 kingdoms mode, and then there were 4 kingdoms, because someone else who could have become a kingdom took the capital of one of the other ones. So I actually had 4 kingdoms and 7 duchies. It might have been 8 duchies at the end, actually. that was just a wild ride. I had a great time with that. I've also heard people who play as Zheng Zhang, like, she just has so much stacked against her that winning the game is pretty implausible, but just the machinations that you have to do to survive make it a fascinating enough campaign on its own.
Yeah, and I did a campaign as her, and I think what happened with me is I just got really lucky, because the early game just went so well for me that by the time the consequences caught up with me, it didn't really matter. I just had so much momentum. I did make her Empress of China. And I think it mostly stemmed from the fact that very, very early on, I signed, like, a coalition. I became really close with Cao Cao. And it was weird because he absolutely hated my guts. Every time we opened up, like, dialogue, it would be like his icon was red, and he would just talk about, like, what a treacherous snake I was. But he would never betray me, and he would take all the heat for me constantly. And because of that, I was able to take over China. But yeah, with Zhang Jiang, that was somehow I had the one lucky run, but she definitely does have a lot stacked against her. And also, true to history, when you declare yourself empress, a lot of people have a lot of problems with the idea of a woman in charge. So,
yeah, although I'm not sure if that's significantly more than the number of problems with literally anybody in charge, but...
Yeah, that's true. I'm trying to, one of the reasons I want to try and make Lu Zhi work is I would love to have a campaign where when I made emperor, basically everybody was like, I mean, no, obviously there were people who were against me, but like for the most part, people were cool with that idea, like a respectable emperor. Maybe that's just not doable.
I hear Cog Rong is good for that.
I hate Cog Rong. I believe you when you say that, but...
I mean, do you hate playing as him, or do you hate him because he's a jackass?
I hate him because he's a jackass. I hate him because he, like, he just constantly is messaging me to be like, hey, can I buy this off of you? And then if you say no, he's like, seems stupid to me.
Right. Yeah, like, he's apparently got this whole, like, merchant... king thing going on where you can win primarily economically by, you know, developing your trade routes and stuff that I have not tried in a significant fashion yet, because I basically, it's hard for me to play without having the Dynasty Warriors in my crew, you know?
Yeah, I understand.
I want to have a smashy guy or a shouty girl there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got nobody, like, not even himself. Like, he's a, you know, quiet strategist level type. So maybe someday I will give it a go, especially if and when they add more characters into the North that can be recruited who are unique and plenty shouty.
Yeah, I'm hoping, I mean, this is not the North, but like speaking of like future stuff, I feel like I would love to see them adding like the Man tribe, like Meng Huo and Lady Zhuang and all that.
Yeah, they've said that Don Mon is on their table, and I suspect that that's going to be, like, the first really big, like, map-changing expansion as opposed to campaign expansion. And I would definitely love to see them and the tribe that I forget that Wu dealt with coming from the south, and possibly some invaders coming from the north, especially because, like, once you take that northeast, it's really hard to get knocked off of that, but having some sort of counterbalance to that from, you know, Xiongnu invaders or maybe some Koreans might be an interesting way to balance that out. I would love to see those things in addition to just adding a few more campaigns and adding a lot more unique characters.
Actually, now that I think about it, that's a big part of how I won with Zhengjiang, is that I just swept northwest and took the northwest corner and sort of went through there.
Right, where, you know, the reason that they have Ma Teng there and all these, like, strong warlords is that it's actually super dangerous in China to be there. And they have, you know, what they would call invaders or barbarians or marauding tribes come in and make it not, you know, the economic heartland of China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Like, it does end up feeling a little weird how, I mean, obviously this game's about the Three Kingdoms, and I don't have any problem with the fact that it's limited to China. It sort of needs to be. But the fact that there is almost no outside influence whatsoever does feel strange at times.
I mean, depending on where you mark the end of the Three Kingdoms era, it is theoretically an outside tribesman who wins.
Spoilers.
that's not really in the book. It might be in the afterword or like a discussed in the chapter, but the book focuses on Jin winning, and but the Jin only lasts like 30 or 40 years before it gets split apart into multiple other civil wars. And
I've been led to believe that the it says here the eight princes fuck it up.
I have heard that somewhere. Yeah, like that's the first civil war. Then the next civil war, like immediately following someone winning that, is I 17 something, and like half of them are Jin and half of them are outside invaders who settle in China and take on the heirs of legitimacy. And one of them who becomes emperor is from the Liu clan, and like I think this is mentioned in the afterword of the book, because it's like a way to propagandize Liu Bei as having won in the end, is that there becomes a Liu emperor in like 317 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But depending on how you mark the end of the era, you could make the case that it is the outside invaders who win in the end.
So for Jen's sake, Jen has not played nearly as much of this game. And I am like, I'm a voice of moderate experience, but I don't think I am on the level of you. So like, what are the characters for Jen that you recommend getting into? And also for anyone else who's listening, who isn't playing a lot of this game, like who are the people you should try out to sort of see what this game has to offer and who will be a good, like, early experience?
I mean, the big four who actually had the chance of winning the emperorship are normally what I would say, and that's, you know, Liu Bei, Sun Jian, or Sun Ce, and Cao Cao, plus Yuan Shao, although they have added a bunch of Dynasty Warriors characters to, like, everyone around Yuan Shao, who doesn't start with any. And, like, I believe they said in one of the videos that a Guandu expansion is next, and I assume that's going to add, like, at the very least, Zhang He. So I've taken him slightly off of the initial best play. But yeah, it's the Three Kingdoms characters are by far the easiest ways to get into the game. They all have some strengths and weaknesses, like Cao Cao sort of can feel like the entire game is built to be handed to you in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Liu Bei just gets these like god level characters from the start, and like if you actually succeed in what you're doing because you have these characters, then he's like set up very nicely in the Northwest, which is somewhat ahistorical and bugs me a little bit. And Sun Jian starts off in the south with basically not much around him, although that has been fleshed out with the last expansion and getting the bandit guy whose name I'm forgetting.
Yan Baihu?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's the south has become more interesting than it did at the start, but he's still got a little bit of a lack of pressure on him, and I like being pressured in my strategy games. I think that's good for learning the game in addition to just having fun. And I tend to dislike things that are like, play this character because they're because no one's going to actually threaten them, and I'm like, no, threaten
for sure. Yeah, that was part of my problem my first campaign as Cao Cao, which was also because it was before all the DLC, and I think the DLC, like, I want to try the 194 start with Cao Cao because that seems like a good way to revisit that. But
yeah,
with Cao Cao, it felt a little too easy.
Yeah, he's got all these like really great warriors and a really great economic base and good ways to spread other parts from the economic area. In general, I think like there is a progression that it's like the easiest characters to go with are the Three Kingdoms characters, the next easiest are the warlords, the next easiest are the governors, and the next easiest are like the bandits and the turbans.
Mm-hmm.
That's...
Well, I mean, if you do the Mandate of Heaven start, playing as one of the turbans is actually ridiculously easy.
Yeah, that start with the turbans or the Han is like, you're just playing like this one kind of mini campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely noticed as Sun Jian that I've gotten to a point in my campaign with him that I had this initial strong forward momentum capturing everything around me, but at a certain point when I was trying to find my way over to Luoyang, at some point, everyone around me just started signing peace agreements, and so I needed to as well. So the last 10 or 20 turns have just been me buffing up my armies and the buildings around me and trying to keep the populace happy. And it's like, it's the sensation of, am I ever going to break out of this?
Yeah. It's difficult for big strategy games to actually have an end game with a U1 screen that's like a challenge to an interesting challenge to get. Most of the time, like, you know when you're hitting the point where you're going to win regardless.
Mm-hmm.
And Three Kingdoms does... Total War in general, since Shogun 2 primarily, has been really focused on trying to find more interesting end conditions and more interesting win conditions. And Three Kingdoms, I think, does a really good job of maintaining some level of challenge throughout and having that end game be interesting even when you know that, like, you're not going to be stopped. The question is merely how long it's going to take, but even that becomes a bit of an interesting thing. Like, it's only the very, very end when it's like, okay, I have this campaign won, I just need to send one army at the enemy capital and march through everything, that it can get a little sloggy. But in general, you have these, like, lulls followed by storms that, you know, were also historical. Like, once they hit the Three Kingdoms level in history, there was, you know, a campaign every 3 years, and then people just sitting around and waiting most of the rest of the time.
Yeah, and I do appreciate how this game does simulate that experience of how things can kind of stall out, you know, but still give you stuff to do, right? I do think that when you're too small, it can stall out in a bad way, but when you're having the problem of, like, I'm one of the Three Kingdoms and there's just so much on my plate, that can be a really healthy thing for the game.
Yeah, and I think that the Liu Xi thing might be coloring you slightly there, because it seems like he's so screwed by his start.
Mm-hmm.
In general, I think the start tends to be pretty exciting for most characters. There is, like, the gamble of, am I going to be able to successfully toss this army into the mix without losing anything behind me? All those things. Mm-hmm. The diplomacy, I think, has been upgraded a lot from any other Total War game, which is pretty necessary, as the setting demands having a strong diplomatic screen. The whole quick deal thing, like, I think that got added to Total Warhammer, but before you had to, like, go and click on every single diplomatic option just to see if they would take your trade agreement or not.
Mm-hmm.
In previous Total War games, not Three Kingdoms, but the quick deal screen is really good. The various options of how to bring people into wars and stuff, and trade for land, even if sometimes you end up trading, like, here's three horses, give me your richest city, and then somehow that works. But
yeah, they do. It is a weird thing where I feel like there are two parts of the trade agreements, or the diplomacy, that feel weird to me. One is the way that, like, the trade ancillaries, the items, are, like, disproportionately powerful. And then the other is, I feel like there have been a lot of instances, at least for me, where, like, I will talk to someone and I will try and make all kinds of deals, and they're like, sure, we can have peace, you know, like, I'll have their back to the wall, they'll have nothing left, they're like, sure, we can have peace, just give me three cities and, you know, 10,000 gold, and you're like, no, piss off. And then you hit next turn and they say, here, give me peace, I'll give you 5,000 gold, and you're like, that, you wouldn't have taken that deal 5 seconds ago. It's just like, when they propose a deal, it feels so different from when you do.
That's interesting. I haven't noticed that, but it sort of makes sense with how I've noticed diplomatic AI works in strategy games generally, where there tends to be more negative aspects to the the deals that you offer versus the deals you get offered.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a little a weight in there that adds like a plus 10 whatevers to deals you get offered and a minus 10 to deals that you offer.
Mm-hmm.
I had that happen with me. I accidentally ended up picking a fight with Liu Bei at an early point where I was not prepared at all. And when I was trying to be like, okay, what can we do to resolve this? He was like, okay, since you're the one offering peace to me, I want your capital city. And I was like, well, I can't do that. And I just sat around with him menacing me at my border for a few turns before he was like, if you just give me this really small lumber yard, I'm totally cool calling peace between the two of us. And it's like, oh, okay, that's way better than what you were expecting like a few months ago, but I'll take it.
Yeah, and you know, some of that might be that their material conditions change in ways you don't know. Like they may be fighting a two-front war and they had an army get wiped somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Or the AI expects to be making progress and doesn't. Like I know in EU4, and I think in CK2, no, CK2 has a totally different setup for how it does war. In EU4, there is basically a minus 50 to any peace deals from the start of a war that goes down over time, because everybody thinks they're going to win at the start of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be things like that in this game. It's not quite as quite as transparent in those things as Paradox Games or Civilization is, but it's pretty transparent in that. That could be an aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fair. I just wish I had a better feel for it. I think, and it's partially because I feel like the tutorials are generally pretty, like the teaching in the game is pretty good. I like how no matter what faction you pick, you have Lady Yan is her name, I think, who's just like, she's always in your officer ranks and she's always narrating sort of like early tutorials and the state of the game.
I didn't even notice she had a name, but perhaps, yes, she is generally helpful and pleasant to have around, which is, you know, an improvement over a lot of tutorials.
Mm-hmm.
The big thing, and this is probably not an issue for listeners of this podcast, but the only major complaint that I had about Three Kingdoms, like I have situational complaints about the historicism and some of the battle tactics are a little iffy, but in terms of just like overall, the game does not really tell you about the history of the Three Kingdoms if you don't know it already.
Mm.
That's the part that I feel like could use more help. Like, you and I know how exciting it is if Cao Cao is not one of the Three Kingdoms, right?
Sure.
That's because he's given like the biggest heroes and the best starting position and is, you know, the hero of chaos that is supposed to. He's the main character of the story for the first 30 years, mm-hmm. Regardless. He's the main character of the history, regardless of the story that is told. That sort of like narrative generation aspect is not quite as clearly told through the game to people who don't already have that background knowledge, which is a little bit unfortunate, but it doesn't seem to be stopping a lot of people from being like, okay, I want to get into this game and I want to learn. So,
I mean, how would you want that to be incorporated? Would you want it to be like an option where, like, I think CK2 has this, where like on a character's profile you can click a thing to learn more about them historically, or would you want like an option to compare the state of the world to what it actually was at this given time?
Well, that would be interesting, but yeah, like the CK2 Wikipedia link would be much better in this because it's like a 2 or 3 generation long thing as opposed to a 50 generation long thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, you click on, you know, a Dynasty Warriors level character and the only things that you see about them that are like factual are their like nickname, which I mean, that those are neat, but they don't actually say anything. And then there's like a one paragraph kind of flowery summary or metonym for what kind of person they are. But it's not like you click on a Zhuhong and see, you know, this is a former bandit who turned into one of Cao Cao's greatest generals across 40 years. Those sorts of things are missing. And, like, I feel like even those slight paragraphs might help, or, like, the full encyclopedia that you could click on in the game. There's a gameplay encyclopedia, but there isn't, like, a hero encyclopedia like there is for, like, even the Dynasty Warriors has that, although the interface is not built for finding and reading things.
Sure.
But,
yeah, I think in large part, like, as, you know, I started playing the game pretty close, pretty shortly after it came out, and at that point we weren't as nearly as far in the book, so I was encountering characters who I didn't know yet. But I would get, like, for me, it was like, oh, I know this character is cool because they have unique art.
And yeah.
It's like, it's a weird way for that to be your experience of it.
Totally. Yeah. And it seems like the game itself is presented in a way that seems like it assumes familiarity with the text for anyone playing it. Like,
Yeah, that's the big thing.
Mm-hmm. The way that they set up the whole, do you want it to be more over the top or more grounded, is romance versus records, kind of paralleling how there's another version of this story aside from Romance of the Three Kingdoms that tells it in a more grounded fashion. And something that Six tipped me off to is that if you shoot Xia Hao Dun with arrows, it gives you an achievement called Eye of the Beholder, mimicking the whole thing where he got shot in the eye with an arrow and plucked it out.
And ate it.
Yeah.
It's a really important detail, Jen. You can't just leave that out. Yeah.
Do you all know Brian Smalley, a.k.a. Chef Lu Bu, on Twitter?
I don't.
Well, he is all about the Three Kingdoms, as his nickname might imply, but he's actually, like, super into the history and gets really angry at how certain characters are treated as, like, great heroes when they were actually kind of either total assholes or miserable losers. And he's mad about Zhao Houdun because of the latter, and basically says if he wasn't Cao Cao's cousin, he would have been executed for failure, like, a dozen times. And that always amused me because he's, like, presented as the ultimate badass for having eaten his goddamn eye.
Yeah, I mean, he had that one cool moment, but, like, the book does, even though the book is a lot of propaganda, the book does actually make it clear that he does kind of suck.
Yeah.
I believe he dies because he's really worried about Cao Cao and he just keels over dead. I don't know, I guess I was getting ready to ask who in their right minds picks the records mode, but perhaps Chef Lu Bu does.
No, I think he's all about the grand pageantry and so forth. I know there are people who are, like, really into Total War as war game who like the records mode, but every time I've tried it, I've just been like, why am I playing a version of this game with 30% less personality? I don't want to do this.
Yeah, it just seems like the no fun allowed mode.
Yeah. But yeah, like, I've seen these mods that are, like, all about doing really good things to the tactical mode, which is definitely something that could be improved and made closer to Shogun 2, which I love to death for its tactics. And I've seen these mods that do all these things, and, like, they say, oh, at the very end of listing all of the updates they make, they say, only works in records mode. And I'm like, who wants that?
So perhaps you could enlighten us, because Jen, you're not a Total War person either, right?
Yeah, like, my one experience with Total War before this was buying Medieval 2 when I was a much smaller child, and playing it on a computer that could barely run it, and it didn't teach me anything, so I bounced off it pretty hard.
So
how large of a child are you now?
Can I get different large answers from the different people on this podcast? I guess, yeah, so what I'm curious about is you've made several references to the fact that, like Shogun 2 did a lot of the tactic stuff better, and I certainly believe you. I wouldn't know what that looks like. What do you think, like, tactically are the problems with this game?
So, cracking my theoretical knuckles and getting into my Total War nerdery, back in the 2000s, I got into Rome Total War modding pretty hard. And there was, like, a super famous mod for that called Rome Total Realism that, like, basically was a revamp of the main campaign that got rid of some of the most egregiously legendary or bullshit things and generally rebalanced the battles in a way that tended to work. And that was good. But the ones that I got into was, like, there was they created this, like, super ambitious idea. It flamed out, disappeared, and a bunch of other people, like, got their hands on the name. And they made this version called Fate of Empires, which was, like, just the Western Mediterranean, and had the most amazing tactical combat that I had played in any of the Total War games. And what that entailed for me was that it's relatively fast. You want to be able to finish a battle in, like, between 5 and 15 minutes. Second, you want the battle to feel like you have control over it. Like, it's not just, oh, that their army is bigger or stronger than mine, and therefore I lost. It's, oh, there was a tactic that I maybe did that could have saved something, or whatever. And then the third thing is, you want some sort of momentum swing possibility. You want, like, the ability to throw your reserves into a key point in the battle, and that turns the tide, because that's the point where things were going to crack. And Shogun 2 had this better than any other Total War game. There were two parts to it. One might be primarily aesthetic, but Shogun 2 had really good formation options that were not just, like, missile front, melee back, which are the only ones that are in, like, almost all the Total Wars since. I think the Rome 2 had other options. It just happened to be terrible at everything else. So you had these, like, these crane wings that would have these, like, asymmetrical formations that were theoretically set up in a way that the battle system would actually make this a viable defensive formation. And then you would have morale starting to break in mass. The thing that makes Total War battles start to get really bad is when you only have morale break for one unit at a time.
Yeah.
You don't cause a general rout. This leads to what I call the scrum, where it just ends up with, like, 10 different units sitting in the same spot, punching each other in the face until only one is left. That can happen a bit with Three Kingdoms, that can happen a bit with Warhammer, but in general, those games are good at having the formations and the troops break as an army en masse, but not, like, at the first sign of defeat, so that you actually have the chance to alter the game. Or alter the course of the battle. So that's the thing, is, like, you want to have at least one kind of macro-level tactical choice. When do I throw in everything I have at this one spot? And then I also would love to have more formations, because I have gotten to the point where I basically do the same thing every battle, because 95% of the battles are me putting my troops in a strategically advantageous position so that they have to be attacked by possibly a slightly stronger enemy army, but because I have the defensive position and set things up, I am able to just kind of redo that battle over and over and over. And I would like there to be more variety in how that works, which I think would come from more variety in how formations are set up, and a little bit of a tweak to when and how units break and run, and if they stay broken and running. That said, there were a bunch of minor tweaks that added up to major tweaks for the patch surrounding A World Betrayed that did kind of switch it from a B to a B plus tactically, in ways that I think have made it like roughly equal to Total Warhammer, which was generally better. And Total Warhammer does still have like monsters and all sorts of crazy fantasy shit that makes it more interesting, like in terms of sheer variety. But I think in terms of the tactics being satisfying, I think Three Kingdoms has passed it, but they're still behind Shogun 2 because that just hit like the exact fast pace, intelligent tactical decisions, armies breaking and running that I wanted. Huh. And the big thing was that Rome 2 utterly screwed that up.
Mm.
That game was, the tactics were just a disaster. Most things about that game were a disaster, but tactically, like, it was a system that was just not designed to have armies breaking and running. It was all about hitting individual units. So the series has sort of been in recovery from Rome 2's engine messing things up. And Warhammer was like a big redemption for it. And Three Kingdoms was maybe a little behind that, but has eventually come to that point.
Hmm. Okay.
And I do probably want to go in and check out some mods to see if I can tweak it any further, because obviously, like, there are advantages to the accessibility to have it being the way it is, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
It's not complicated. It is very oriented around these big superhero generals. It is, it doesn't make you feel like you have to have a firm grasp on the tactics in order to succeed. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of, these armies are going to punch each other, and you may or may not have that much control about what happens, but at least it'll be fun to watch. That's not a bad thing. Like, it's fun to watch things that are fun to watch, but I would like to see if there are some possibilities for tweaking it for my very specific niche needs.
Yeah. On the other hand, though, as like a, again, as a player who's like new to this sort of stuff and probably pretty bad at this, I have felt frustrated on occasions where it's like, I don't know, like I'll have an enemy army attacking a city, and I don't have an army there, right? I just have the garrisoned troops, the sort of the built-in, you know, building defensive troops, and I have superior numbers, and the delegate says, like, ooh, you just barely lose this. And I know that if I take command, I cannot win it, because I don't have a hero there, and so what's going to happen is I'm going to get in a fight, and this morale is going to immediately evaporate, and everyone will run away.
Yeah, and that's also because those garrison troops never go up in levels.
That's true. Yeah.
They're always level one, and it is extremely easy for any other troops in any battle to go up levels rather quickly. So I almost never actually fight those battles unless I have somebody there, in part for that reason. The exception is the battles that exist on the like smaller like lumber yards or fishing ports or whatever that have like four or five entrances.
Mm-hmm.
You can really cause the attacking army to get stuck at a choke point and fuck them up real bad. It's pretty hilarious. It's like, that used to be the way to play Total War. The AI was given so many advantages that the goal of the game was basically finding a choke point where you could just never lose it, and then eventually being able to like sneak an army in and wreck their stuff behind enemy lines.
Hmm.
But that still lives a little bit in those particular battles that not farms, because farms are just like straight up flatland, but most of the other smaller things have like some variation on that where you can channel enemies into a choke point and then have a lot of fun with them. Hmm. I had one campaign, I think this was my Liu Bei campaign. No, because it was against Cao Cao, unless he switched sides. But going back to Zhao Hudun, I had this giant battle where it was a mining town, I think, and I had like two armies defending it, and he had like 3.5 armies attacking it, and it just turned into like him trying to channel everything into this one spot, and I was able to like send a cavalry outside a different exit from the town and hit the back of their army when like everyone was plugged into it. And I was like, gosh, it's really unlike Zhao Houdun to put all his troops into a place where a single charge would have them all be massacred horribly.
How ahistorical. I think my favorite battle that I had was like a 2-army versus 3-army battle I had as Lubu, where it was in the middle of this map that was just like scattered snowy woods. And what ended up happening was it was just like everyone was losing line of sight constantly. And so I was able to sort of generally anticipate the movement of the AI, and basically any time one of their generals popped out of the woods, Lubu was standing in front of them and stabbed them, and then just sort of like kept just running around playing, you know, like a horror movie with them. I can't recommend the Lubu campaign enough. He's so fun.
Yeah, I definitely preferred the sort of strategic quirks to the campaign for him and Sunsei compared to a lot of the somewhat generic ones from the 190 start. I could see them doing a revamp of those things at some point because they are so relatively straightforward. Whereas the Lubu, Sunsei being so momentum based is pretty interesting.
Yeah, they're definitely very, you know, they added a lot more personality to it in a way that's very good.
Another thing going into like these big climactic battles is the way that the strategic layer of the game has been changed again, I think, with that World Betrayed patch, where the campaign I was doing before that patch with the 182 start where I was Liu Bei, I had this situation where basically I was like all strung along the northwest coast, and Yuan Shao was by far the biggest superpower of the game and like right next to me, so he would be at war with me every now and then. And I basically came into this Guandu type situation where he threw everything he had at my capital city, and I like just managed to barely fight all of them off, and then his army was just gone like everywhere. His economy was gone, his army was gone. And it was this really interesting strategic historical parallel where the way that Total War stays challenging is it basically gives the AI a bunch more gold. So the AI can field like twice as many armies as you can with much higher quality troops, and you're just better at fighting them in the right places and then potentially fighting them on the tactical layer. So I hit this Guandu moment and I was like, holy crap, that's an amazing finish to this campaign. Like, it wasn't the full finish to the campaign, but once I hit that and was just able to like swipe the rest of his stuff out of the north, like that was that made me the premier superpower. And after that, it was I think I basically just gave up that campaign. I didn't decide to finish the whole Three Kingdoms mode with it because it would have taken too long and I was clearly the dominant force in China. Having that mode was a really interesting strategic thing, but then in the 194 patch they've changed it so that I don't know if they changed how the AI cheats or if the AI cheats are like more subtle, but now it's generally feels like you're on the same rough page as them, as opposed to how does this guy have an army filled with the like super elite imperial level units and I don't have a single one yet. So they've done really interesting things in making the strategic map feel viable even when it's sort of game broken. Another example of this is the Southlands, which Jin has probably noticed, is that so many of those things are just, those towns there are just not like held. They're not developed. Nobody cares about them. You can just like walk in and create this giant Southland empire just by having enough money to colonize the towns or rebuild them or whatever it is in Three Kingdoms. But the amount of money it takes to do that is so massive that you're basically stunting your economy's growth everywhere else. And they created, like, by not having the Southland work, and seeming like this big, like, colonizable terra incognita that anyone could go and create an empire with, they actually had, like, it balanced in a way that made that not as viable as you might think. So, yeah, there's all these weird little strategic components to the game that it's like they're breaking it in exactly the right ways.
Yeah, and there's been moments where I'm expanding my territory a little too far without understanding exactly what I'm doing to my popularity in those areas. So there's been a few times where I'll set up and suddenly everyone's really angry for a reason I can't entirely discern. And by the time I'm trying to patch everything, I have to divert all my resources to just fix whatever I started by expanding a little bit. And that kind of quashes my forward momentum trying to get other objectives completed.
Yeah, the economy is shockingly well balanced, especially if you played previous Total War games, where, like, you can get to points where in those games where population and money were just, like, unbalancedly out of control, or you had, like, this perfect set of trade routes in the Mediterranean that just made it impossible for anyone to compete with you. In Three Kingdoms, it feels like you have the amount of money to do the thing you're supposed to do, but barely be on the edge, like, at all times, which is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. You're constantly having to make the choice of, like, okay, I could raise one more army to try and have, you know, better odds, like, fighting this war or fending these people off, but it is going to cost me. It is going to dip my budget.
Yeah, and then you're like, you're getting, you know, 3,000 gold per turn instead of 10,000 gold per turn, and you can't build the big buildings. Which is, you know, all these little choices are, you know, Sid Meier's axiom of a game is a series of interesting choices, I don't think is actually true for all games, but it is definitely true for what makes for a good strategy game.
Mm-hmm.
And this game does a good job with making sure that most of the parts of it have interesting choices.
Dipping back to my Lubu camp, just continuing to praise Lubu for one more minute. That was part of what made that so great, was that Lubu has such a big problem with corruption. That, like, the more he does better as a warrior, the more corrupt everyone gets because they hate him so much. So by the end of that game, part of the reason everything fell apart was it was impossible for me to have a positive budget. I had to have a negative budget and make up the difference by raiding places. And then there was the turn where I wasn't able to get armies in place to start a fight that turn. I didn't have a battle that turn, and everything came apart.
Yeah, and, like, there have definitely been times where my economy, like, can get kickstarted just by winning one big battle.
Mm-hmm.
Even without someone who's so, you know, built on the razor's edge as Lubu. There's just this kind of the right benefits for doing the right things. And then there's also times where, oh, maybe that's kind of wrong. Like when you take a city and you're like, oh, I can get, you know, 3,000 gold for sacking this. That's not going to do so much damage that the 3,000 gold wouldn't work. But then you're paying like 20,000 gold or 2,000 gold to repair the city, and it's slightly smaller and you're getting less profit. It's like, was that really worth it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those mechanics are really, really fun. And just it seems like there's a lot of good options at a lot of stages. Or sometimes there's no good option, but that's the point.
Yes. Jen, was there much more you wanted to talk about? You've been fairly quiet.
I haven't played as much, so it's one of those situations where I'm still trying to get through my first full campaign, so to speak, or at least have my first full failure. One thing I did kind of almost wish was in this game that might accidentally unbalance it, so maybe it's not a great idea, but it'd be fun if you could do more, if you could set up more traps, kind of like what Kong Ming does a lot of the time in the books. Like, I'm not asking to create like that stone maze that instantly kills anyone who doesn't know the way out, but it would be nice to have situations where, okay, I can do the old pretend to retreat and then come back on them with an ambush when they're chasing me. And
yeah, some sort of formalized trick system.
Yeah, because a lot of the sea changes within that book, or even just the tide of battle turning in those book is about having small tricks like that played off.
Yeah, like there are aspects of it, like Zhang Fei has his roar that can definitely swing the tide of battle. But the strategists tend to have more, their strongest abilities tend to be more passive. Like there's one that a strategist can get where they basically cause anyone near them not to be able to use their abilities. They add like 5 seconds to the cooldown every 5 seconds. And that can definitely swing a full battle, but it's not a thing that you feel like you are definitely doing. It's not a it's not a button that you press that launches the full fire arrows. And that's generally the case with most of the kind of strategist options, is that they're all like partial gameplay things that you could theoretically set up to create an ambush or whatever. The other thing I would love to have fixed about this game is that the fire at will button doesn't work in like the actual ambush battles. So because I'm not terribly good at micromanaging my troops into like firing at the right people all the time, I actually find that getting the ambush on enemy armies is worse than just setting up a solid defense with my towers. Please fix that bug, Creative Assembly, please.
Yeah, and I also sort of understand that having tricks work the same way as they would within the book would be difficult, just because you're dealing with an all-knowing AI that has to pretend to play ignorant rather than actually playing off a enemy faction's like the points that they don't consider as much just because it's part of their personality. But
I mean, the thing that might be able to work is that you could have your top tier strategists have abilities that like force enemy armies to do something. That I think would be a successful way to pull armies into existing possible traps, like the fire arrows with the oil spills and so on. If you gave your Kong Ming and your Zhou Yu and your Sima Yi's those sorts of things, that might be a way to add that to this game. I'm interested to see where they go with expansions, because both of the ones they have done now successfully, the Eight Princes was not super successful, I think.
No.
The ones that people like were the 182 and 194 starts, and the 182 start gives you like this totally different potential setup that you can work with. And the 194 start is honestly where the campaign begins in earnest in the books. Like in the history, there's a lot more going on in that time period between the end of the Coalition and the rise of Lu Bu. But in the novel, it's basically all these capital area machinations and Sun Jian dying, and that's about it. So like the actual campaign begins at that point, and after that everything is just kind of increasingly consolidated. So I'm not certain that like if they just do like, here's our 200 start date, here's our 208 start date, here's our 221 start date. I'm not certain that those things will actually be as successful as they might want them to be, but adding things like strategist tweaks or external invasions or even perhaps an expansion of the map to the south, these things, like, maybe the direction that they find more success with going, but I don't know what their development time on those things might be. It's probably a lot longer than I think, and they're already set up for the next 3 years or whatever, but mm-hmm. yeah, there's like I said, I'm looking forward to Guandu because I think Yuan Shao is kind of screwed right now, but other than that, I think that those new start dates might not be what they want.
But speaking personally, Rowan, aren't you totally okay with Yuan Shao being
screwed? Okay, I am okay with Yuan Shao being screwed, but I would like his lieutenants to be the, like, full characters in the game, because, like, it's a big deal that Guan Yu can kill Yan Liang and Wen Chu without even trying, right?
Yeah,
it's a big deal that Zhu Xu is a genius that Yuan Shao never actually listens to. And then, you know, I already talked about Zhang He, who's, you know, one of the Wei five generals, I believe. If not, he's close enough. Mm-hmm. But, like, he's probably the most obvious character who needs to be unique and isn't, except maybe Cao Ren. I don't remember if they added Pang De or not yet. I don't remember how to pronounce that one.
The problem with Cao Ren is that Cao Ren, like, I feel like there is an implication that by making someone unique, you're making them, like, powerful and good. And Cao Ren did a lot of stuff, but also, like, maybe Zhao Hao Dun-esque in the fact that he was not super successful.
Actually, if you ask Brian about the history, he will say that Cao Ren is one of the most successful generals of the entire era.
Really?
Yeah. I don't remember exactly all the details of it, but yeah, he is extremely Team Cao Ren.
Huh. Well, maybe Luo Guanzhong has successfully brainwashed me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you think that Kang Ming was a good strategist, so...
I think he was a dickhead.
That too. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the hilarious things about the novel that I find is just the way that it will go out of its way to have anything related to Liu Bei be treated as heroic and noble, even as Liu Bei is backstabbing his way across China.
That sucks so much. Oh, I hate him so much.
Yeah, it was fun watching Red Cliff while we were in the midst of those chapters and seeing how John Woo was, in comparison, very stark about... He was very obvious about how he felt about Xuanda and his other brothers. Like, oh, these people are just running away when this pestilence is becoming a thing. They're cowards.
Yeah. I mean, like, he's barely in that. Like, it's pretty much all about Wu with a couple helpers, which is, I don't know, probably an extremely accurate way to do that when you're not writing propaganda. Although that is a thing that the introduction or the afterword to the translation that I have talks about, is how almost all the histories or fictionalizations will present either kind of all three kingdoms and heroes as neutral, or Cao Cao as evil and Liu Bei as good. But they'll never have, like, Cao Cao as good and Liu Bei as evil. Or, you know, conniving or whatever, whatever value judgment you want to put on him. And that's a thing that the Three Kingdoms game does, is it doesn't put, like, these huge value judgments on the characters, and does give you the options to play as big of an asshole as you want to be. But there's still this, like, propaganda-esque thing where Liu Bei is always about, we have to do things for the people, when Cao Cao is always, like, you know, his ability is to force people to go to war with each other, which is, like, conniving incarnate. And, like, but they're also presented fairly neutrally. Like, you're not the bad guy for playing as Cao Cao. You just have the ability to kind of be an even easier jerk about things. It's an interesting thing, the way they put it together. And I would also be super interested to know how wanting to sell the game in China affected that as well, because yeah, it does seem like there's a lot of leeway given in how you portray the Three Kingdoms, just because there's so much non-Chinese pop culture about it. But having the very clear villain in Dong Zhuo and everyone else being some level of neutral to positive is something I find interesting.
I want to nominate Dong Zhuo for, like, the best NPC of 2019. He's so funny. I just remember, like, over the course of any campaign I've done during the time where he's alive, just, like, the arc of him, like, starting out, just, like, he would, you know, every turn demand that I vassalize myself to him. And then, like, just the steadily growing desperation of his requests. it's art, really.
Yeah, he is a very good kind of center of gravity for that original campaign. I never actually managed to click with playing as him, which is a little sad because, like, geographically he has one of the more interesting starting locations, but the whole need to constantly be sacking cities goes against all of my no build things nicely impulses. I tend to be a relatively moral strategy game player.
And the game has its own set of morals, too. Like, if you try and do something like attack someone immediately after you've declared peace with them, everyone talks about how much of a big dick you are in terms of your... It gives you, like, a likability rating or trustworthiness, and that can nosedive if you do anything too quickly.
And that's really notable, too.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there have been times when I have had to take that hit, and it's been rough afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can bite you in the ass pretty hard. Some might say you never overcome it with some games.
Yeah, although, you know, that's a fun thing. Like, even in my Yuan Shu campaign, like, I had a point where literally the entire map of China was either red or green from being either my vassal or at war with me. And, like, surviving that, figuring out the points to make progress, especially because, you know, Yuan Shu is so central that means that, like, I am surrounded on three sides, even four sides when they come down the coast sometimes. Like, that was a blast.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's everything that I've got.
Yeah, one thing I was just going to ask is, how long do they typically release expansions and stuff like that for these Total War games? Because I noticed that they have another Total War game coming out later this year.
So the Total War game that's coming out soon is, I forget the branding that they used for it, but these are kind of like moderate-sized Total War games that are... They have like three or four different teams in Creative Assembly that kind of rotate on things that they're working on. So there is a Total War Three Kingdoms team that is going to be continuing to make things. That said, as mentioned, like, I think there are a couple clear expansion possibilities for Three Kingdoms and after that, I don't know what there might be. Once they add Nanmon and once they, like, flesh out the characters, like, this is a fairly complete collection of stories surrounding Total War. On the other hand, they might have more success going to an entirely different time period if it's a more famous time period, like the Warring States period. But in general, it's really hard to predict because there are so many potential options that they may or might not take. Total Warhammer, which is technically two games but is kind of the same project, has been releasing things for like 4 years. Might be five. When did that?
Oh, wow. Okay.
first one came out. And they're supposed to be releasing a third game for it. Yeah, May 2016. So 4 years. They're supposed to be releasing a third game for it, which will also have its own expansions. But all these games are supposed to combine. It's a bit of a mess. I think for Rome 2, they were releasing things for like 3 or 4 years afterward. The other thing they start doing, or have started doing, is release like medium-sized campaigns. Like Rome 2 has a Charlemagne expansion. That kind of thing. I don't remember if that's a standalone or an expansion, but it's built off of Rome 2. So yeah, something like the Warring States, they could potentially release as an entirely different game that would be sort of still part of Three Kingdoms in like a production sense, but not necessarily in a player sense. So yeah, it's hard to say, but I think we can expect at least like 3 or 4 more expansions.
Okay, cool.
Well, I could not be more excited. Would love to have you back on the show sometime, but if even if that doesn't happen, I'll hear more about it on Three Moves Ahead, I'm sure.
Yes.
Or on your Twitter. Where can people find that?
That is at Rowan Kaiser, and I will post my maps from all of my future Total War Three Kingdoms games, because I love posting maps. Oh, that's another thing that the game could use. Seriously better colors on the map, like having every major character be a shade of brown. And there are mods for that, but I don't know what was up with that Creative Assembly, but I use the mods, so my maps are pretty. I love telling the story of what has happened in these campaigns, because it is such a good simulation of the era. So that's at Rowan Kaiser, and yeah, those are the two big things for me publicly these days, are the Twitter and the Three Moves Ahead.
All right. Jen, where can people find you?
So I'm at JBU3 on Twitter. Most of my stuff is split between scanlinemedia.com and patreon.com/scanlinemedia. We have a anime podcast on there, a movie podcast, and a role-playing podcast. And aside from that, we also have a Novel Not New, a True End podcast, which is... It basically covers visual novels and adventure games. That's over on the Abnormal Mapping Network or readinggames.online. And later next week, we're going to be recording on Kindred Spirits on the Roof, which I'm pretty excited for. That's a interesting game.
And I am SixDetmar. You can find me on Twitter at SixDetmar, SixDetmar. I do too many podcasts and stuff. So just check scanlinemedia.com and patreon.com/scanlinemedia. Rowan, thank you again so much for being on. It was really great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And until next time, folks, read on.
Read on.